Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants. They all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, listeners. I want to tell you about a sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, they host different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Oteil Burbridge, Trouble No More, former members of The Band, Milk Carton Kids, Nikki Glaspie, Bill Frisell, Sean Colvin, and many more. This June, join the Fab Four, Joan Osborne, John Sebastian, Marshall Crenshaw, and a great group of faculty for the debut of Magical Mystery Camp. This all-inclusive, once-in-a-lifetime music vacation experience in the heart of the Catskills will be packed with nightly performances, workshops, speakers, song circles, open mics, and a lot more. If you're a performing musician at any level, bring your instrument. If you're a music lover, bring your good spirit. It's an amazing experience for individuals, friends, and couples alike. Registration is open, spots are filling up, so check it out soon. And scholarships are available. Check out magicalmysterycamp.com/helpingfriendly to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ben Sawyer, and I'm the co-host of the Road to Now podcast on the Osiris Podcast Network. Each week, my partner Bob Crawford and I speak with experts to discover how history has shaped the politics, culture, and economy of the world we inhabit. I'm a history professor and stand-up comic, and Bob is a founding member of the Avett Brothers with a deep knowledge of history and theology. Together, we work to bring history to the public in a way that is informative, accessible, and, we hope, entertaining. You can find the Road to Now podcast anywhere you get this Osiris podcast or on our website at www.theroadtonow.com. That's www.theroadtonow.com. We hope you'll join us on the road and that you thoroughly enjoy this episode of our fellow Osiris podcast.
Everybody, thank you for tuning into the Helping Friendly podcast. This is episode number 161. My name is Jonathan, and I'm here with Matt. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, man. I am doing great. I coming back from a weekend of awesome music out at the Watermelon Park Music Festival, and feeling recharged and ready to take on the world.
Cool. I saw RJ posted some pictures from there. Did you leave him up on the mountain?
Yeah, so you know, there's that whole paddle fest right here, banjo music thing, and there was quite a bit of paddling and floating and banjo music, and I don't know, man. He just he went off into the mountains and he's having a walkabout or something. And hopefully we'll see him again soon.
Yeah, would be nice. And I presume Brad is still floating wherever RJ left him a few weeks back.
That's exactly right.
Okay, well, let's we have a couple things to cover in this episode. We have a guest that we'll get into that interview in a minute. But first, we really got to talk about the Vida Blue show we saw.
Hell yeah.
So by now, everybody is aware because all three of the shows happened.
That's right.
And we saw the first one at 9:30 Club, and it was pretty rad. Trey Anastasio very much did not sit in, but he sat nearby.
And he was cool. He was sitting. He sat for a while in the VIP section,
grinning over the balcony at the band. He seemed really psyched to be there, just as the rest of us were.
Yeah, it was funny. You know, there was all this Willy Wony kind of drama going into the show. You know, people had heard rumors that Trey was in DC that day, and so there was kind
that
of
was
like
true.
Which was 100% true. And so there was two camps. People were either like, well, of course he's going to sit in with Paige because it's his buddy, but and then other people were kind of the school of thought of like, well, no, it's Vida Blue's first show in 15 years. He's probably going to let it be. And I don't know. I think from my understanding is that up until the very last minute, he himself may have been back and forth. But regardless of that, I have to say, I mean, as if the sort of juju of, you know, having the first Vida Blue show in 15 years wasn't enough, that definitely turned up the energy in the place to 11. A lot of anticipation. And the couple times that Trey sort of peeked his head out, if you know the 9:30 Club, there's this sort of perch above the stage that's connected to the green room. A couple times he peeked out just enough to be seen by the crowd, and it was like there was this collective raising of energy, which was great. And the music was just phenomenal, wasn't it?
Music was outstanding. Yeah, that's what I really want to focus on. It was great to see Vida Blue again and to see them in 9:30 Club again. O'Teal was outstanding. Russell was killer. The new guitar player, his name is
Adam Zimmon.
Adam, thank you. I kept wanting to call him Andrew, but I know that's not right. And it's not fair to him. He was terrific. He had a little gear trouble like three songs in. He stomped out to his tuner and couldn't get the guitar back until halfway through the next song. But other than that, these things happen at first shows, right?
Yeah, and it was interesting. I went back and listened to the audience recording, and we were up super close. We were right in front of Adam, a couple of people from the rail, which is actually it's Paige side, but Paige is not Paige side in Vida Blue. So there was all sorts of communication
really
issues. Yeah. So we were right in front of Adam, and I realized when I listened to the audience tape, he was not that loud in the mix. And I don't know if that was just figuring out things first night or if they're just sort of like keeping him more there for texture for most of the time. We were hearing him loud and clear coming off of his amp, and he was you know, especially when they played Sheep, he was,
oh, that was so
really
good.
Really, really in your face. But I think he's a great addition to Vida Blue. Both textures rhythmically, and then, you know, there's a couple of times when you just need a rock and roll guitar to step out front and play a lead. He was there for it.
Right, and I don't think I said that Paige played great. I think I kind of skipped him, but that wasn't intentional, Paige. You were awesome, as usual.
Of course, so. Of course, yeah. And the album is great.
It really is. I picked it up that night.
And yep. Yeah, we were able to get it a little bit early, a couple days before release day, because they were selling it there at the merch table. And I haven't spun my record yet. I have listened to it on the streaming services. Excited to spin the LP, because this is another one cut by Chris Bellman at Bernie Grum Mastering. So it's going to be great sounding, I'm sure. It is a great sounding album on the digital stuff too, and a lot of really good songs on it.
Yeah, the LP does sound really good, and it's also a pretty blue.
Yes. So
if you're
yes,
into that sort of thing.
If you dig the colors. But
that's not why I buy them, but no. I pulled it out, and I was like, oh, that's quite lovely. And then it sounded terrific.
So, yeah.
Yeah, all around a great time. And apparently at the Cap, Paige hinted at more shows to come. So let's hope that happens so people can see this, because it was well worth the time.
I think I like this you know, possible future where you have Phish tour in the summer, maybe a run in the fall, something around New Year's, and then all of these gaps throughout the year are filled in with like Mike touring in the winter, Trey Band doing some stuff, Vita Blue playing some stuff. I mean, let's get Pork Tornado back together, man.
I want Bad Hats.
There you go. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that was a lot of fun and looking forward to that. And of course, Trey is going to be doing some shows here before too long. Mike just announced a tour after New Year's, a winter tour.
Yeah, winter tour.
And because we're recording this now, New Year's will probably be announced tomorrow before this episode drops, because that's how it works.
Most likely.
And that'll be fun. But yeah, lots to look forward to. So let's talk about this interview.
Yeah, so Jonathan, you connected with Nick Sanborn. And first off, just remind us where we might have known Nick Sanborn from before tonight.
Well, Nick is one half of Sylvan Esso, which is a great duo. He's an electronic musician, and his partner, Amelia Meath, is a wonderful singer based out of Raleigh. And they make really cool, kind of housey, dancey pop music.
Sweet.
And so he's kind of in with the Wisconsin. He's part of the Wisconsin group that overlaps with the Megaphone guys and Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, and all of those guys. And so he's played up at and he gets into this in detail in the interview, but he's played up at the Justin Vernon's festival up there at the Eau Claire Festival.
Right.
And
right.
A couple of times he and this guitar player, Chris Rosenau, have done these improv sets where he's playing his electronics and Chris has a guitar and they play basically ambient instrumental music, and they decided to make a record. And so this record that he's here to talk to us about is billed under the name Rosenau Sanborn, and it is called Bluebird, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, I knew Nick from his time in Megaphone. They made some great, great records. I always love that one that starts off, I think it's the self-titled record that starts out with real slow. That kind of thing is just really perfect for, you know, my kind of speed in the morning or some weekend listening. I really got into that record a lot.
Yeah, we talk about his time in Megaphone too. Well, it may not be obvious, but it may be known to some of you that I'm a huge Megaphone fan as well. I saw them and taped them a bunch of times. And yeah, so we get into that. And then we also get into the fact that he's a huge Phish fan.
Awesome. Yeah. And so how did you connect with Nick?
You know, just the usual way. You hear about an album and somebody wants to talk about a record that's out. And, you know, do you know any Phish blogs? Or any Phish podcasts? I do know a Phish podcast, and so here we are. So we had a great talk. We talk about, you know, the records. We talk about, you know, where he comes from musically, and of course we talk about his Phish history. Not detailed stats, but we get first shows and some other stuff. And he's for real.
Yeah, and the new record, the Sanborn and Rosenau record, you hipped me to that when we were talking about, you know, interviewing Nick, and it's a really, really beautiful record. That's another one I've been kind of spinning in the office a lot recently when I have some work going on. It's very nice, sort of pleasing background music.
I'll say that anybody who listens to this record and listens to this interview, that it'll make sense when he started listening to Phish and the kind of music that he's making here with this record, at least. There's a correlation. So I won't. No spoilers, though. You have to listen to find out.
But yeah, we'll include some music at the end from that record, so that you can all get a taste of what it's like.
Absolutely. So hang out and hear that. But I'll tell you, you can get the album at rosenauandsanborn.com. It's actually rosenausanborn.com. So Rosenau. Sanborn, Sanborn.com. We'll put it in the show notes, so please check it out. It's terrific. He's terrific. And yeah, this is a good talk, I think.
Awesome. So let's go to it. Let's hear Jonathan talking with Nick Sanborn.
Thank you.
we'll jump right in. I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I really love this album, Bluebird, and I'm excited to talk with you about it and how you and Chris Rosenau came together to make it. It's a real treat to listen to.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm obviously a fan of the band and a fan of the show, so I'm stoked to be here.
Cool. Yeah, and we're gonna get into Fish fandom and the like here in a bit, and I think folks are gonna enjoy that. But I really want to start, if you don't mind, kind of back to the beginning, and just because. Partially because I didn't do super in-depth research on all of these things, and some of this stuff I only kind of know. So I was wondering if we could just start at the beginning. You could tell me where you're from?
Yeah, I'm from Middleton, Wisconsin.
you're one of those Wisconsin guys.
Yeah, I'm one of the Wisconsin guys.
There's a whole cartel of you guys now.
Well, I know you guys talk to Steve Hyden on the show every once in a while. Yeah, so you know that we're everywhere.
When did you start making music?
You know, tough to say. I was in band and orchestra when I was a kid. My dad is a really great guitar and mandolin player. So when I was little, you know, he would teach me chord progressions and how to play the guitar a little bit. And, that always was just the coolest thing in the world to me. So I got into playing in school kind of the minute they let you. So, cool. But it wasn't until, you know, it wasn't until like high school or middle school, I guess, that I really had like bands with friends or anything like that. I kind of always thought that was something that was like reserved for people who are cooler than me or something. I'm not sure.
and since then you've found out that it's, if anything, it would be what makes you cool, but it really doesn't, probably.
It really doesn't, yeah. And well, it's just dorks all the way down. It's like the Turtles thing, but it's just dorks. That's the entire music industry. It's just nerds. It's great.
Well, anybody who's a Fish fan can, you know, certify that as reality because...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and that was where... I mean, getting into Fish, that was, for me, like, the gateway was being in jazz band, you know, and playing bass when I was a kid. You know, they were just at the time when a friend showed them to me when I was like, you know, 14, 15, you know, that was just the coolest exercised version of the thing that we were all working on. You know what I mean? It was cool to see that, you know, all the scale practice could turn into something that we actually all thought was cool instead of, you know, just playing, I don't know, Duke Ellington, yeah, or whatever, which is very cool. But at the time, you know, it was like, oh God, another Duke Ellington song. You know, it was like that.
Right. When you're 15, it might seem a little tired or old fashioned or whatever, but
yeah. I think that was the thing. I had that crappy view that it was old fashioned at the time, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's what teenagers are for. They're there to despise the old and create something new.
Yeah, I'm mainly despising the old. Maybe that's the crowning teenage achievement.
Yeah, it leads to the other stuff, hopefully. Hopefully, yeah. It's you mentioned playing bass. The first time I saw you, you were playing bass for Megafon, who is a band that I still love quite a bit and miss.
I miss them too.
They were, yeah. They're so good. Tell Phil I said so.
I will.
they're Wisconsin guys, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they transplanted to North Carolina. Did you transplant at the same time or thereabouts?
No, I came much later because I was kind of their touring bass player and electronics guy for the last like year and a half, 2 years of them being a band. It was just the last record that they put out. So they had moved a long time. I think they moved in like 2006 or 2007. And I was still in Wisconsin at the time. And playing in other bands, and another band I was playing in was coming through, Chapel Hill, and Brad hit me up to see if they could open. And that was, I think, Megafon's like second real show.
Oh, wow.
Was opening up for, this band Decibel-y that I was in way back in the day.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I saw them a number of times. I saw them several times before I saw you in the group. And then you relocated sometime in between.
Yeah. So, I mean, like we had been friends. I met those guys when I was like 18, like in a freshman in college. And we had just been friends the entire time. And when they started that band, I just always thought that band was kind of a high watermark of, you know, what you could do with structured improvisation in a, you know, a folk music context. They're still, I think still those records are just so far out, and those tapes too. If you look up the kind of, I think NYC Taper has a few tapes.
I made a couple myself.
Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah. They're, I mean, they just like, before I was in the band, that was always that, those were my friends who I thought were doing the most interesting, stuff in that zone, in the, like, you know, it's a different set most nights, and the jam sections really go in different directions all the time. And it's, you know, they were a very present band in that way. And so they were always kind of somebody I wanted to play with, and we were always friends. And then when they made that last record, I think they realized they needed another person. And I kind of was like, you know, hey, please take me out. Like, I really want to do this. Yeah.
Outstanding. And soon after that, you know, Megaphon parted ways to go on to other projects. And soon after that, I got word that you, I think they actually promoted your next project, which I think was Made of Oak. It's an electronic music project that you were doing.
Yeah, that was kind of like a catch-all name I have always used for any time I was doing something by myself. But it wasn't until after they stopped touring that I, you know, like made an EP. And that was also when Amelia and I started working together. It was kind of right around all that same time.
Right. So I read some of that background, and I guess she hit you up to mix one of her tracks that she had recorded.
Yeah, we had played together. She's in a fantastic band called Mountain Man, who are all in the other room having dinner right now, by the way. I did a remix for them. I opened for them, forever ago in Milwaukee when I lived there. And we kind of became fast friends. And she asked me to remix a song of theirs. And then that went so well that we just kind of kept in contact and started working on more stuff. And that was kind of right towards the end of when Megaphon decided not to tour anymore, was right when we were kind of really getting serious about making a record.
And that came out under the name of Sylvan Esso.
Yeah, that's right.
And I hadn't listened to some of that material for a little bit, so I dug back into it in preparation. And it's terrific how, you know, you provide this electronic beds, but her voice has such soul and humanity to it that it really sets it apart from a lot of what otherwise might be, you know, just, I don't want to say it's club music or dance music or just electronic music. It's something else. It's great. It's nice synthesizer music and all, but this fusion of your sounds is greater than the sum.
Yeah. I mean, thanks, man. That's like, you know, the whole goal for us is how do we make something that, you know, I think when we usually call ourselves a pop band, but to us, the interesting part is that it feels, we want everything to feel very human and, real. You know, I think a lot of music that gets that same label, feels, you know, inhuman. It feels, you know, perfected in a way that I feel like doesn't represent my experience as a human. You know, things get like oversimplified and kind of dumbed down, and that makes sense because you have to, in communicating a message sometimes means making it simpler, and that's not to, you know, discount that music, but we just have always thought that there was a space there for music in that world that dove into how messy and complicated being a person is.
Well, I think you guys managed to find it, and it seems like other people are picking up on that. So that's terrific. But that actually leads right in my mind, to where we are now and why we're really here is to talk about your new record with Chris Rosenau, Bluebird, because you talked about making something that sounds human and simple, although, yeah, I might use the word minimalist myself because it's not simple. It's just not over complicated. It's not overdone. And it's also immediate. This record is, I guess it's recorded in over a course of a couple of days. And as I understand it, it's basically live in a home type studio.
Yeah, we did the whole, I mean, we have always improvised together, and we just wanted to make a record of that feeling. So it's just 2 days, and we wrote and recorded everything just as you hear it. You know, we'd improvise until we kind of found the thread of a thing. And then the minute it felt exciting, we'd stop and we'd go hit record, and that's what the record ended up being. So we wanted to make something that felt very immediate and that embraced that nature of kind of jamming and improvisation.
And you guys, this stemmed from some performances originally. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. We had, Justin Vernon, another Wisconsin dude, because all Wisconsin people know each other. he has this festival called Eau Claire's up in Eau Claire, where he's from. Every year. They actually didn't do it this year, but they've done it 4 years in a row outside of this summer. And that was the first place we did this. We had played in bands together before. I'd played in Chris's band, Collections Colonies of Bees, a bunch, and he'd helped me on a bunch of projects. But that festival is, and if anybody hasn't gone, I would highly recommend it. It's my favorite festival. And for this exact kind of reason, they booked us all because me and Amelia played as Sylvanesso, and so I was going to be up there, and Chris was there with Collections of Colonies of Bees, his other band. And they sent us out an email being like, hey, if anybody wants to do anything that's not their normal set, just let us know and we'll make a rehearsal space and a venue happen.
Wild.
Yeah. And I mean, can you imagine that happening at like Coachella? Like, it's just not a thing that happens.
I was for my other podcast, the Brokedown podcast, I was ruminating in my latest episode about sort of that very thing. I was talking about how Woodstock 50 hadn't happened, and then, you know, what the value of Woodstock and maybe, you know, what was missing from that festival at that time is it had all these amazing artists, but you know what you don't have from at Woodstock 50 years ago? There's no sit-ins, there's no crossover, there's no real interaction from all those artists, and there are not many places where that does happen.
That's a really good point. I never thought about that, about the original Woodstock, but that's totally true, and it kind of goes against the remembered spirit of that festival, you know, kind of Eau Claire's really does that, which is the coolest thing. And they encouraged it. And we, like, Chris texted me kind of right after we got that email and was like, hey, would you want to do a thing? We won't be able to rehearse. I'll just have to fly in and we'll just do it. And I was like, sure. And they just gave us an hour long set in a geodesic dome on the top of a hill. And yeah, exactly. And it was great, you know, and it was, and we just had a blast. And then we did it every year after that. I think we got rained out maybe the last year. But that getting rained out was what made us want to make the record, because we felt like we got robbed, you know?
Oh, wow. We then all benefit, because I haven't heard any of these live sets, but this thing is, it's just terrific. So there's a word I haven't used to talk about it, which is ambient.
Yeah, sure.
Which I think applies. It really... The record captures the space and time and moment. What kind of, do you have influences? Where did you learn about electronic music? What were you listening to that steered you into playing with these kinds of sounds?
Oh, I mean, it's tough to say. I feel like where I'm at now with how I use that stuff and how I play is like, is this point in like a, you know, 20-year-long journey with that stuff. So it's tough to, you know, it's tough to like limit it to one thing. I think, you know, like when I was much younger, bands like Autechre, who I think are still doing crazy stuff, in this world, that band, the band Moom, you know, there's all these groups that I think changed the way I thought about how an electronic record could sound. I think, you know, when I was a kid or when I was a teenager, especially kind of in the, you know, mid to late 90s, you know, if you just said the word electronic music, you were probably listening to like, you know, Paul Oakenfold's Transport Volume 1 right. or something like that. It, you know, it was like, or it was like on the great end of it, it was, you know, Portishead and Massive Attack. So discovering like Warp Records and, you know, Mute and all these kind of like weirder labels, when I started working at record stores was really an eye-opening experience. Cause it showed me that like, this wasn't at all, this didn't have to be about what I thought it had to be about. You know, it didn't have to be about this like thing, which is like, you know, no shade on that. That's great. But like, it could be personal and it could be, you know, weird and it could feel human. It could be a different thing, you know? So that's like started this huge journey into, electronics. I mean, like at the time I first started hearing that stuff, bass and saxophone were my primary instruments. And then kind of over the course of the last like decade and a half, 2 decades, this has become my main instrument. And I don't even know if I can really say what this is.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah, I was exchanging emails with somebody today. I said, "Oh, I'm going to be talking to Nick Sanborn about that Bluebird record," and he's like, "Yeah, oh man, you should ask him what kind of gear he's using." I said, "I wouldn't know. You could make up words, and you know."
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to run you through it, but I don't think I worry that kind of misses the point a little bit. I think that especially with electronic stuff, you can get caught up in the gear.
It's like what, did you ever see the Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii?
This
interview segment where Roger Waters is very defensively saying, you know, it's not about the synthesizer. You don't buy a synthesizer and become Pink Floyd. So, and
well,
that's true,
I'm not
right?
sure I'd go quite Roger Waters on it, but I guess I worry that people are too, and myself included, I'm guilty of the same thing, but you get locked into this idea that, that the piece of equipment is the thing that did it. Or that solved the problem for you. And that's just like never the case. If anything, a piece of equipment, I think, puts you farther away from the finish line, of, you know, of like trying to communicate an emotional reality, which, you know, isn't that kind of the whole point? Because I feel like every time I get some pedal or whatever the fuck, you know, I think I'm doing it thinking, oh, this is going to unlock a thing for me. But what it really does is mean like, well, I have to learn how to express myself through this thing now. And that's this whole, it's a whole nother instrument I have to learn. You know,
it's an additional, you know, layer to filter.
Yeah,
through.
I spent 20 years getting good at playing bass. And I think I can just buy a sampler and that's going to solve all my emotional problems. Like, no, that's not. Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. But so I get, that's the only reason I hesitate to really delve into it is that I feel like, you know, like even kids, like especially with like the Sylvanesso stuff, you know, I'll get kids being like, oh my God, what did you use for this sound? And I'll try to, I like won't remember, you know, and like not even trying to be shitty about it or anything. It's just like, I don't totally remember what it was like. 5 years ago, like, I don't remember, you know, for whatever song they're talking about. And I'll be like, well, it sounds like a two oscillator synthesizer. One of them's a square wave and one of them's a saw and one's tuned a fifth above the other. And then you kind of low pass it about here. Like, that's what I would guess. It's probably like that. That's because they're always kind of disappointed.
Oh man.
And I'm kind of like, no, man, it's the
magic.
Yeah, it's like, but it's the concept. It's like the idea is the important thing, like the concept of the sound or the concept of the musical idea. Like that's the important part. And I think you can, I think it's easy to lose that in the, and think that like, well, this Moog Voyager is the answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I still play the same acoustic guitar I've been playing for 30 years. So
see, that's I kind of love about that though, is that like, you know, guitar guys can get into, you know, what acoustic guitar you're using and what pickup and all that stuff. But that conversation is so short. Like, I love how short it is.
It can be, unless if you ever watched a rig rundown with a guy.
I
like
guess that's true. Yeah. Yeah. So, I've watched a lot of rig rundowns, but you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I feel like, yeah. I feel like no one's looking for, you know, the ultimate answer. Like even with Trey, you know, people are like, well, it's kind of the Ross compressor and a tube screamer. And that's, that's right. The deal. He's just a great guitar player.
Or, like, you know, just this tour's flavor thereof.
Yeah, right, right.
So, yeah, let's back up and talk about, you mentioned that you got into fish in high school. Is that, did I hear that right?
Yeah, yeah. My first show was Alpine 98, August 1st, 98, when I was, I was 15. Yeah.
That's a good start. So Alpine.
I mean,
so
I had a feeling, talk about a lucky first show to go to. Yeah,
yeah, really. Alpine, of course, I knew was a given for a Wisconsin guy.
Oh yeah,
but and then 98 tour. I mean, those are that. So that's a time frame when Fish was actually exploring more ambient jams, but also they were doing a lot of you know, a lot of interesting covers on that summer tour.
Yeah, well, and I think one of my big takeaways from that show, and it was also kind of, they were playing all the Story of the Ghost stuff. That was kind of, they were bringing it all out then, you know, like that's right. When, you know, Brian and Robert showed up and, but yeah, I mean, even looking back, I think, you know, it's, you, any fan of any band, there's no way to know if, when the arc is that long, there's no way to know, you know, ideally how lucky you are that you're in a certain zone when you get in. I mean, that was like right after the Island tour, which I think still looking back is probably my favorite shows to go back and listen to. But it was just I mean, what an era, you know, like so many totally complete shows. But yeah, that's like that. And I still think that space is the thing that keeps me coming back to that band, you know, very kind of spacey, emotional, those jams are, I think, the thing that really hooked me, you know, like, when Ghost would get Way Out or Hood, that kind of space was the stuff that like, that really got me back then and still.
So were you regularly seeing them through your college years and whatnot? And
yeah, I mean, I saw them consistently. I never went on tour. I did, you know, I would do maybe two nights in a row, but I never toured. But yeah, I saw them. Let's say 15 times between then and when they took the hiatus, something like that.
Okay.
You know, yeah, like not a crazy number, but like I was definitely going every chance I got, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. So Alpine, was it, God, first thing you saw was Ramble On was the first song. That's
a, which was great too, because like, I mean, I had heard a live one, but I didn't really, you know, I think they're like fucking Fugazi, man. They're a daunting band for a newcomer, especially back then when like all the information wasn't at your fingertips, you know, like it wasn't, there wasn't the instant doorway into all of the deep cut knowledge that there is now, you know, like, not to sound like an old guy, but you know, it was so much more mysterious.
You really had to work to learn about things and you had to literally network with the, you know, people out there in the world to get tapes and to hear stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was the bar for entry was high. You know, and so I think that was the thing I was mostly taken with, was just the how intensely their fans loved them, and then how deep you could immediately tell that the well was, you know, especially as a kid who was, you know, getting really into bass and jazz at the time, you know, and practicing like hours and hours a day. It was like this glimpse into this whole world where like that was a thing that people gave a shit about, in a totally different way than I was used to. And so then like going to that show with friends, kind of being like getting dragged there with friends a little bit, and then having them open with, I think they opened with Ramble On, and then they closed with,
Been Caught Stealing.
Yeah. Jane's Addiction.
And
yeah.
Tweets a Reprise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wow. Good. Yeah. Good one. Yeah, and I remember at the time, like, I had heard that song on the radio, but I didn't know who it was. I mean, I was 15, you know?
That's fair.
So I remember being like, I didn't think this was them. Like, is this, like, did they save this song for the encore? Because it's like, they're single right now, you know? Like, I was, like, confused about it.
Did anybody and then it, sort you out?
Yeah, well, and also at the time, I mean, like, think about who else to this day is coming out and... outside of like Steve Earle is coming out and encoring with a song that's like currently on the radio that isn't theirs.
Right.
You know, like it was just this, it was like, it was so confident and so fun, you know, like I think that was the thing that kept bringing me back was like how good it was and how the whole thing seemed to be about like resonant joy. And that one show then sent me to, on a, you know, a 20-year odyssey of going to see them.
I'll tell you, I was home. I didn't go to that show, and I was so sad to see they covered. Well, Ramble On was enough, but then to see that they covered, because I loved Jane's Addiction when I was in high school, and we didn't. Yeah. Jane's Addiction was broken up at the time, so I was
of course
absolutely floored to see they had just played that. Yeah, so fortunately, I got to see a couple other set tour, but so
Kill. I mean, listening back, they really kill Ramble On like a few nights later, right? I think it's like a week later that's like the canon version of that song. Yeah, I've been dipping back into kind of 98, 99 lately. I went to a show. I went to October 2nd at the Target Center in 99.
Oh, cool.
And that show. I hadn't gone back to in a long time, and that is one that if anybody out there is looking for a 99 show to dip into that maybe isn't an obvious one, that's like such a complete show. That is an amazing show. Like perfect set one, perfect set two.
Yeah, that's set two. It's Tweezer, On Your Way Down, Piper, yeah. Enjoy Myself, Frankenstein, yeah. Waste.
Yep. Wow. Oh, yeah, exactly. And it's like perfectly emotionally arced. You know, even set one, like right when they bring in Rage, you're like ready for a breath. You know, it's not the kind of classic thing we all love to complain about when like the show's really cooking and then, you know, they play a downer. You know, it's like it's the opposite of that. But even that, like the end of Tweezer, the way, you know, Mike starts teasing On Your Way Down and they all pick it up. It just feels like, not that I don't like the shows when Trey's really running the ship, but like it really feels like everyone is there on that show. And like it feels like it can go anywhere and all the transitions just land so hard. It's great.
Thank you.
It's always that the best when they're all driving the ship together.
Yeah, oh yeah. And that Piper is like one for the books, man. It's just, it's insane.
Yeah, Birds of a Feather jams in that one, apparently.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah. I gotta ask, have you seen, I mean, you're a touring musician now yourself. Have you had time to go see them since they've been back?
I have. So I went to both the nights at Alpine in 2009, like right when they came back.
Oh, cool.
I've been on the road so consistently since then that I didn't get to see them until the Baker's Dozen.
Which night did you go to?
Jam-filled. I just got lucky.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
And that was like, you know, I hadn't seen them in, I mean, that was what, 2017? So I hadn't seen them in 8 years. And we were in town, me and Amelia were in town playing Celebrate Brooklyn. Cool. We were like, oh, we gotta go. Like, let's get tickets. And we just randomly got them for the Tuesday because it was the one night we could go. And then it ended up being that show. Amazing.
Is she a fan or simply fan adjacent?
No, she is fan adjacent, but, okay. Like she's down, you know, like she's, cool. Like ready. Like, you know, that she was like, oh, you want to go? Like, I'll totally go. Like, and, you know, like I think being, this proximal to a fan, she now like knows, you know, a lot of songs. Like she can tell from the intro of a thing, you know, she has favorites. She has. Yeah. So like for somebody that's who cool. I think would not have been into it had, and maybe that's like a lot of people. I mean, there's such a specific band, you know, I mean, and I think it takes a certain outlook to immediately embrace them, and otherwise it might take longer or it might never happen, you know?
And most of us need somebody to show them the door.
Well, very also because there, I mean, there's just
come
so
to fish
much
entirely by themselves.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I mean, there's so much, and the doorway is a different door for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, that's a thing I love about that band. And I think about all my favorite bands is that their work spans such a breadth of like the human experience that figuring out how to show, you know, a certain person why they would like them it takes some thinking. Like I love that about them.
Yeah. And that's beautifully stated as well. Can I ask, I don't know that we've gotten this from you. Is there a single song, if you were to take one Fish song to carry with you?
I mean, that's such a tough question.
I know, it's not fair.
It's not. The question to me is like, I feel like, am I taking a jam or am I taking a song sometimes?
I would leave that open to interpretation. I wouldn't want to impose any more rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to split it, or if I was going to split it, which makes it easier, I'd say that Train Song is probably the song that has affected me on every level, at every wow. age. That's just a near perfect song, I think. But then, you know, I just keep coming back to Hood, which I know is like super vanilla, but like, man, does that not, that song, just every time they break it out, it just tells you everything that is great about them. And that jam does the thing that I think I love that they do more than any other band, which is that space, that emotional, quiet space that jam starts, where it feels like when the sun rises on like the first morning of spring, you know, where it's just like, everything's just waking up. Like that quietness is just a thing that is it's just one of my favorite emotional places that band goes, you know?
Wow. Yeah. I'm with you. I think Hood would be one of my top five. And I think the placement thereof just depends on which day you ask. So
yeah, no, it's totally true. And I rotate constantly. I mean, we're as fans of this band, I think we're you know, spoiled with the amount of material we have to go through on any given day.
Yeah, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches.
It's insane. Yeah. And so it's to me, it's, I definitely go through, I mean, like all of us, I'm sure I go through phases of, you know, what I'm digging into and what angle I'm looking at in the archives, and in any, you know, 6 month period of, you know, any year of my life or whatever. But that's probably, those two have probably been the most consistent as far as like, I think if they drop Train Song in a show or like, you know, like a Swept Away Steep combo, you know, like that space, kind of that zone of Billy Breeze, I think is my favorite thing that they do.
There's something about what they were doing when they made that record. Actually, it's unlike anything they've ever really put out with that kind of intent. And yet it's really just buried. They were so, you know, they were recording, you know, note for note, you know, just like, I'll record a passage, then you go in and record a passage, and you might could delete a passage, but then you can record a passage, and just making this insane collage of which there's really only a brief
minute. Yeah.
Yeah. A brief bit on the record. But I think that intense inward gaze really set their minds in a certain way that everything else they put into that record just came out.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it really sounds like a record made in the wintertime, you know? And I think, you know, like, you know, if I were going to, you know, if I like produced a Phish record now, I think that's one thing that I think I would push them to do again is find the quiet moments to counterbalance kind of the larger moments. Just because I feel like that the balance to me is what makes them such a great band. You know, between all these different elements, you know, which is why it's so hard to like show someone the band, because it's like, well, it's not really about a song. It's not, you know, there's no one thing. I mean, we might be able to say this now, we can talk about the Yems or the whatever, you know, this far into it, but that's only because we know so much and have listened to so much. Like showing somebody who doesn't know what it is a song, I mean, what are you even, you're giving them a sliver of the thing. You're giving them a tiny slice of this whole pie, you know?
Even to expand it to just play them a show, you really only...
Exactly. And even then you're asking them for like 3 hours of their life, you know? Like it's like...
Right. All right, this is a tiny example of what they can do. It's 3 hours. Oh no, this is nothing.
Yeah.
So the breadth of the catalog, they're... capacity for dynamics just in and out of, you know, any, even in a single song, not to mention across, you know, a show or even within a whole tour.
Yeah.
It's daunting, but
it is
goddamn terrific.
But I mean, yeah, it's a thing I keep coming back to it with that breadth idea is the silliness, which I think is a really divisive element of the band.
It's critical.
It's critical. It's so important. And it's, I think that, a thing I think about a lot and think when I'm like talking/arguing with my friends about the band, this is a point I come back to all the time, which is that, you know, my life as a human being is just full of silliness. Like silliness is such an important ripple in my emotional existence. Like it's such a huge part of how I process the world. But it is almost non-existent in representation in a lot of the music that I listen to. You know, I mean, like I can't think of that many other bands that embrace silliness as a key part of the human experience. You know, and not even in like a Ween way, you know, or even like a They Might Be Giants way, who I think are even a closer band as far as like the way they interpret silliness as a counterpoint to kind of resonant sadness. But like they thread it in the same way it's in at the same proportion that it is a threaded into your life, you know, and they don't shy away from it, even though it's like has gone from objectively uncool to just mildly uncool in popular culture.
Yeah. You know? They've really been unashamed, unabashed about being their, I want to say true, and I think it's true-ish, silly, goofy selves on top of, in addition to, or, you know, along with their virtuosic musicianship and whatnot. And I think anybody who is a, you know, serious Phish fan, serious being probably the wrong word in this element of the conversation, but
yeah,
anybody who is a committed Phish fan has to be able to appreciate it. It baffles me every now and then when I come across somebody who just doesn't get or enjoy the gags, the ridiculousness that is inherent to so much of what Phish does.
Well, I think it requires, and I think a thing that has really made me embrace it in my adult life rather than in my kind of teenager 20-something life is that that to me is started to be kind of a marker of somebody who hasn't really figured their shit out. Not that you like will love Phish if you figured your shit out, but
well, I mean, it's certainly a good sign. No,
but like, I think that there's, you know, I listen, I'm sure we all did listen to Analyze Phish. And I think that argument, even though it was, you know, tongue in cheek most of the time and in jest, there's a truth to that argument that was happening there in this central kind of duality between Harris and Scott, which is, you know, I feel like on one hand, Harris, and this is a thing that I didn't even think about until listening to this podcast, but like that he was always looking for something to enjoy in the music, that was his first instinct. And Scott was always looking for something to mock or insult in the music. And listening to that, I just realized, like, I know which one of these people I want to be in my day-to-day life. Like, if you know, again, not trying to insult Scott Aukerman, but like, to me, it became a worldview thing, especially with art. I mean, obviously this doesn't translate into much else, but like, I'm just not super interested in if somebody doesn't like something. I don't think it's a very interesting point of view. Generally speaking.
Spending a lot of time on the internet, I see that a lot, and I have, I'm sure I've done my share of that in the past.
Oh, me too.
I've been making a very conscious effort over the past number of years to, if I don't like something, that's okay, but I'm not going to spend time talking about how bad it is or whatever, because other people like it, and that's good for them.
Well, and why would I, especially if it's not political, if it doesn't have greater ramifications, you know, right, what good could possibly come of me ruining that person's experience?
Exactly. You know, like, plus, I can spend my energy talking about the thing that I do like.
Yeah.
Which is a lot more fun and will put out, you know, much a better vibe into the world.
Well, and also it's like, I mean, if I'm listening to you talk, I'd so much rather get a window or have you show me the doorway into an enjoyable experience I otherwise would have never been able to access, you know, maybe, you know, like there's so much stuff that, that people talking positively about it has encouraged me to experience that I never would have done otherwise, because it just wouldn't have, you know, gotten into my world. It wouldn't have been a part of my life, you know? Yeah. The older I get, the more I'm like, oh, that's just so much more interesting. Like, show me how I could enjoy something if I have the capacity to enjoy it. That's just so much more interesting to me.
I think I give Scott Aukerman a little bit of credit that I think he was also trying to entertain us, and he did it pretty good.
That's why I don't really want to criticize. I mean, he was, you know, right, he was playing a role.
Exactly.
And he was trying to make us laugh, and he did, you know?
He did.
I don't know.
He did a great job of it. Thank you for coming on and sharing with us your thoughts on Phish and your record, Bluebird, which we will play a track from after this, I think. And I think everybody's going to love it. I love it. And it dovetails nicely with our talking about Phish from 98, back when Phish was exploring more ambient sounds. I mean, they played an entire ambient set at Wheel that year.
Yeah.
So different sounds, but I think relatable to our listeners. I think people will really enjoy it.
Well, and, you know, just real quick before we dip out, please. One thing that I feel like might resonate with other people like me who love this band is just that in that New York Times interview Trey put out a couple weeks ago that I think most of us read, one thing that he said that really stuck with me was talking about, you know, when he'd go out to dinner with young bands and they'd talk about how their favorite their biggest influences were bands from the 60s and whatever, and how he was wondering kind of what the future of like jam and improvisation music might be. I loved that he said that, because that's a thing that like I and my friends think about and talk about like all the time. Just like what, you know, what is the nature, what is the difference between the thing we're all talking about and maybe other forms of improvisation, you know, where are the blurred lines? And what could it look like moving forward? And that was the thing me and Chris talked about all the time when we were making this record, is just like, how can we make something that's totally accessible and yet totally improvised and free?
Well, I think you've done a great job doing that. And I'm not blowing smoke when I say I listen to this all the time.
Oh, thanks, man.
I came to it a while ago. I really do love it. I think folks will too. So thank you for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I really appreciate the show.
Excellent. So that was, once again, that was Nick Sanborn talking with Jonathan. Jonathan, thanks for bringing us that interview. That was fascinating.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And again, folks, you can get this record at rosenausanborn.com. I won't bother to spell it again. Check the show notes. It's probably right there on your phone. And we're going to play everybody one song from this, and then we're going to go. So before we do, let me remind you to check us out on the social media. You know us. We're on HF Pod at Twitter and all of those things. We're on Facebook. And you can subscribe to us on Spotify. I think that's a thing nowadays, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Getting quite a few people listening to us on Spotify now. So thank you for that.
So yeah, you could be one of them. And then, leave us a review wherever that is possible on your favorite platform. And thanks for listening. This is Rosenau and Sanborn, Gentle Guy. Thanks again.
Oh, geez, Dad, not the car again.
Oh, happens all the time with old Betsy.
Have you checked out Carvana yet? They have thousands of cars for under $20,000.
But do those thousands of cars have personality like old Betsy?
Betsy's held together by tape, and there are raccoons living in the engine.
Psh, it's a family car.
There are flames on the hood?
Custom paint job.
No, Dad, the car's on fire.
How many cars did you say Carvana had?
Visit Carvana.com to shop thousands of cars for under $20,000. We'll drive you happy at Carvana.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil story made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.